Professor Burt Newborn is a law professor at New York University Law School and a very experienced civil liberties attorney who has argued many cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and is the founding legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. He has written an exhaustively researched book called Madison's Music, in which he challenges us all to carefully read the words of the First Amendment to the Constitution as if we were reading a poem, paying close attention to the structure as a blueprint for democracy. Professor Newborn is convinced that if we do this, we will see that grave errors have been made by our courts over the years when applying the First Amendment to cases before them, particularly over the last 50 years. Professor Newborn joins us on the phone now from New York. Professor, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
This is an enormously complicated subject and a very rich book telling of the complicated subject. I don't know how to begin this except to say, would you tell us a little bit about the First Amendment, your view of what it does and how it came to be, and who is this Madison guy?
Sure. As you point out, Nick, I've been a civil rights lawyer and a constitutional lawyer for about 50 years now. I was the national legal director of the ACLU during the Reagan presidency. And so during those years, as you can imagine, I litigated an enormous number of free speech cases. And the First Amendment is, of course, the place in the Constitution that protects free speech. And about 40 years into my career, about 10 years ago, it dawned on me that in all the times that I was litigating these cases, I never looked hard at the actual text. I talked about it as the free speech clause, the free speech principle, robust free speech. I had all sorts of fancy lawyer words for it, but I never actually looked at the text, and that's because the Supreme Court wasn't looking at the text either. Nobody was looking at the text. The main reason they didn't want to look at the text is that the First Amendment, if you look at the text, is a very embarrassing beginning. It says Congress shall make no law, and then it goes on to talk about the various things that it protects. But, of course, we don't believe that the First Amendment is only aimed at Congress. It limits the entire government. Mm-hmm. So we've never, from the very beginning, the very first day that the very first lawyer picked up the text, it was not read literally. The word Congress was read as government. The red law, the word law was read as regulation. Mm-hmm. And so we then jumped, because we weren't reading it literally, to a kind of general approach to it that ignored the words, and that finally what the Supreme Court did and has been doing for many years is they take, there are 45 words in the First Amendment, six ideas put there by James Madison, who drafted it back in 1789, and to whom we owe a huge debt for his brilliant work in doing this. What Madison did is he took six ideas that were floating around in the universe. They weren't new. He had 42 texts that he was using, and he plucked six ideas out of those texts. The first idea was freedom from religion. That's the Establishment Clause. Mm-hmm. That guarantees that nobody can ram their religion down your throat by using law to do it. The second idea was free exercise of religion, that everybody gets to exercise their own religion freely without the government telling them that they can't do it. Then he put in free speech, free press, free assembly, and petition for redress of grievances. So six ideas, 45 words, six ideas.
Now, one sentence. It's one sentence as well.
It is. It's one sentence with lots of semicolons and mm-hmm. And lots of commas. Just exactly what lawyers love to do. when you deconstruct it, when you take it, when you say to yourself, "Now wait a minute, I refuse to be defeated by the semicolons and the commas. I'm going to read the text and see if I can make sense out of it." It makes beautiful sense. It makes remarkable sense, because what he did. Yeah, what Madison did is he took these six ideas, He took establishment and free exercise, which are the religion clauses, and he said, what's that about? That's about protecting freedom of conscience. It's about protecting your interior space of a free person to be able to think the way they want. Madison wanted a third clause in there. He wanted a secular conscience clause in there as well, and the Senate took it out at the last minute in 1789, a terrible mistake, which the Supreme Court has fixed by using equality principles to treat secular conscience just the way they treat religious conscience. Mm-hmm. But his two clauses are designed to create free space in your head, free from the government. The government can't make you believe something, and the government can't prevent you from believing something. Well, that's where democracy begins. You can't have a democracy unless you have people who are capable of thinking for themselves. Once you've thought for yourself, then, my goodness, you get an idea. First thing you want to do with an idea is you want to share it. You want to talk to your neighbors. You want to tell people about the idea. That's why the speech clause, the third clause, follows directly after the first two conscience clause. So then there's freedom of speech. But freedom of speech isn't enough to be able to work in a democracy. You have to be able to reach large numbers of people. I'm going to probably reach more people on your program today, Dick, than I could speak to personally in my whole life. So that you need some mechanism to take the speech and get it out to a mass audience. That's why the free press clause comes right after the free speech clause. Now, once you have the ideas out to the mass audience, the next thing you want to do is you want to organize about the idea. You know, political scientists call it collective action. Once those ideas are floating out there in the minds of large numbers of people, they want to get together and try to organize to support the ideas. That's why freedom of assembly comes right after freedom of the press. And once you've got the ideas organized, once you've got people pushing for those ideas, the next thing you want to do is confront the government directly and say, put these ideas into law. And that's why the petition clause for redress of grievances ends the document. It couldn't be any other way. It is a remarkably disciplined blueprint for the functioning of a democracy, written at the very moment, at the Big Bang, when democracy begins. This is the beginning of mass democracy. There were democracies in Italian city-states and in Swiss, small Swiss cities, but they weren't any. They didn't attempt to govern large geographical areas, and most importantly, the electorate was always from a very small social class, either landowners or rich merchants. The United States is the first place in human history where we try to have a democracy that will govern large geographical areas with a voting public that comes from different economic and social classes. And Madison is writing at exactly that moment, and he is giving us the blueprint. He is giving us the code, saying you have to have a free conscience, you have to be able to speak freely, you have to have a free press, you have to have the ability to have that free press, then have people organize in support of the ideas, and then you have to be able to approach the government effectively and force them to confront the ideas up or down. There's no other document in any other rights-bearing part of the world that rivals that for its beautiful organization and remarkable imagery.
And you point out in analysis of many First Amendment cases where the courts have not seen that blueprint.
Exactly. We've lost the ability to hear Madison's music because we think like lawyers. Because, and you know, I trained lawyers for 50 years. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be the guy that's has to plead guilty first. When we train lawyers, we train them to look at the smallest thing possible. You try to shrink a dispute into its smallest piece so that you can deal with it easily and not let it get out of control. So that when I train my students at NYU, I train them to look for the key word, look for the smallest way that you can deal with it. And of course, that's what we do with this. That's what the Supreme Court does. It doesn't talk about having a First Amendment case. It talks about having an Establishment Clause case, or it talks about having a free exercise clause, or a free speech clause. And they never think about the fact that it is part of a larger whole, a larger 45 words, not just the 10 or 8 words of a clause, but the whole 45. They never try to place it in that kind of context. And well, that's led to some terrible decisions.
Yeah, and some of those decisions, I mean, there's so many of them, I don't know where to start. But,
well, let's
but
start if you with take, the worst. Ta- we'll start with the worst.
Take the Bush v. Gore and the Crawford and Citizens
United. Yeah, the campaign
United.
Finance. Well, the campaign finance cases are they're democratic disasters. What the Supreme Court has done is turned over American democracy to 5,000 American oligarchs, the 5,000 richest billionaires in the country, essentially have a stranglehold on American politics. Nobody gets to run for office without their support. Nobody gets to win without raising vast amounts of money from them. They control the agenda. Once you're elected, you know you have to do what they want or you're not going to get reelected. And any trace of the ability of legislators to think for themselves, to make independent judgments, is being slowly but surely squeezed out of the system. And it's all because the Supreme Court says spending money is the same thing as speaking. You couldn't possibly say that if what you understood was that the free speech clause is part of a blueprint for democracy itself. The First Amendment is supposed to be democracy's best friend. And instead, by ignoring the fact that you have this wonderful, unprecedented sweep of words that Madison put in there, that is the blueprint for a functioning democracy, you ignore that and pull little pieces of it out and turn it into democracy's bad parent. Mm-hmm. And that's what it is these days. It's as though someday the parent is too strict and you're not allowed to regulate any part of rich people's control over the process. The next day the parent is completely absent and they won't step in and do something about partisan gerrymandering or the refusal to let poor people.
What are the cases that allow gerrymandering to occur?
Well, it isn't so much that they allow gerrymandering, it's that they say there's nothing we can do about it. There's a doctrine that lawyers know called the political question doctrine, which is if you were going to do a cartoon, the cartoon would be the Supreme Court throwing up its hands, rolling its eyes, and saying, we don't know what to do about this, so please don't bring it here anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what they've said about gerrymandering. They've said, yeah, terrible. We hate it. It's bad for democracy.
How would that change if they looked at it through Madison's eyes?
If they realized that they were dealing with a First Amendment that said, your big job, Mr. Supreme Court Justice, is to make democracy work under the First Amendment, to have democracy-friendly decisions, the first thing they would say is that whenever politicians draw lines with the intent of eliminating the ability of voters to have a real choice over who they elect, they are violating the first principle of democracy. The first principle of democracy is contested elections. If you take a look at the House of Representatives now, there are 435 representatives. In any given electoral year, 400 of them are uncontestable.
Yeah,
uncontestable using criteria by the American Political Science.
Yeah, that's amazing statistics that you cite on how many people really have a chance to change anything in
that's
the House.
That's right. I mean, and so we're living in some sense, and this is what's so frustrating about it, because the country deserves better. I mean, this is a country that is trying desperately to make democracy work. And the Supreme Court is making it harder and harder and harder, and the people are digging in and doing the best they can. But each year, the Supreme Court makes it harder. It creates yet an additional obstacle to making democracy work. And so my book, when I say the Supreme Court, I'm talking about five of the nine justices. It's five of the nine justices.
You call them the Republican justices.
Well, they all happen to be Republicans. I don't think they have to be. Some of the great protectors of democracy in the past have been Republicans. Right. Earl Warren was a Republican. John Harlan was a Republican. They were. You can get great Republican justices, but the five Republican justices that we have up in the court now they unite behind something I call a deregulatory idea of the First Amendment. They think that they hate regulations anyway. They don't like government. They have a mistrust of all form of regulations, economic regulations, all form of regulations. And here the First Amendment comes along and gives them a gilt-edged opportunity to say, ah, we're going to deregulate this entire area. And of course, they forget that when you totally deregulate an area, it's not like you have left the area without any control. Someone's going to come in there and control it. And the person that's going to control it is the most powerful private person. Mm-hmm. So that when you deregulate the airwaves, what you wind up with is you wind up with the largest corporations owning and controlling whatever goes out under the airwaves. And there's no First Amendment way to say to them, well, wait a minute, you got to carry weak speech, too. You just can't carry strong speech. It leaves the democratic process open to control by very wealthy people who come into a completely unregulated area and say, okay, the guy with the most money is the guy that wins. If you've taken the government entirely out of the game, the way the five deregulatory justices do, there's no force that can push back against those wealthy people. Now, the four Democratic justices, and let me say there have been terrible Democratic justices who've been very bad for free speech, but the current four Democratic justices have a very different vision of the First Amendment. I call them aspirational judges. So they see the First Amendment for what it is, as a great hope, as an effort to describe the ideal city on the hill that Madison wanted to create. And they are prepared to tolerate a small amount of government regulation designed to make sure that that system works. So they're prepared to tolerate regulation that says that there has to be some limit on what the rich can spend, that there has to be some limit on how powerful politicians can carve up district lines so that they can never lose. And most importantly, you've got to protect the ability of the poor and the weak to be able to vote. And this business about requiring them to have expensive and difficult to get personal IDs before they can vote is simply a way of keeping poor people away from the polls. And four of the justices would never tolerate that. So we are only one vote away. Only one vote away from changing
and,
a lot.
Who do you hope to reach with your book?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Dick, because the book is not written for lawyers. Mm-hmm. This is too important to have lawyers or judges do it. The one thing I've learned from my 50 years of work as a constitutional lawyer is that the law changes. I began practicing in just after Brown. I've watched the law change. I mean, you only have to look at the legal rights of gay people and the legal rights of women. And during my 50 years as a civil rights lawyer, I've seen the Constitution literally change. And part of it, of course, changed because we had enlightened judges and we had good lawyers. But most of the reason it changed is because the people changed. Because the people wanted a different kind of constitution. They refused to tolerate a constitution that allowed racism. They refused to tolerate a world in which gays were treated as some sort of second-class group of people. They would not allow women to be locked up in the house and not be allowed to go out and be able to exercise their own careers freely. And it was the people's change of view on these things that was eventually reflected in the Constitution itself.
And I think you say that you think the Madison interpretation that you put on it would be supported widely by people if they heard it.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it. All the polls say that the most unpopular cases that the Supreme Court decides are the campaign finance cases. People hate the existing campaign finance system. They see their democracy being snatched away from them. And so the book is written so that ordinary folks will know that if they go home tonight and take they should get a copy of the First Amendment. Take a look at it. They can read it as well as a Supreme Court justice does. Don't be afraid of the semicolons. Don't be afraid of the commas. And when you read it, it will tell you a wonderful story of democracy. And if you fight for that wonderful story of democracy, we will get our First Amendment back.
Well, it's a great piece of work, and I certainly enjoyed it, and I certainly feel I know a lot more about the First Amendment and freedoms that are defined in it. Is there anything else you'd like to add just as a closing thing before we wind up here?
Well, the closing thing is that I don't want to be too pessimistic about things. I mean, since I've lived through what I consider to be a revolutionary period in American constitutional history, I started practicing under the Warren Court, and I've seen remarkable changes. So I'm fundamentally optimistic about the country. I'm fundamentally optimistic about democracy, and I'm fundamentally optimistic about the Supreme Court. But no institution, neither democracy or the Supreme Court, runs by itself. Unless the people press to have the democracy work well, to have the Supreme Court work well, we drift back into situations where the powerful control everything. And so if anything, this is a book, this is a plea for engagement. It is not a formula for being depressed. It is a plea to get your shoulder behind the wheel and join us in fighting to get
the see a way out of what frustrates a lot of people right now. Well, where can the book is called Madison's Music. Where can folks find it? I suppose just Google.
Well, it's Madison. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes and Noble. You can get it on all of that. I hope it's in your neighborhood bookstores. Mm-hmm. It's published by the New Press. It's had a nice reception. I presented it at a number of law schools. The law faculties are excited about it. The students are excited about it. And I'm grateful to you.
Well, it has to make you think. I mean, it certainly made me think, and I'm sure anybody who reads it would be puzzling over how to get out of what we're in right now, because it doesn't fit with, as you point out so clearly, with Madison's vision or the founding writers of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So I really appreciate talking with you, and enjoy your enthusiasm and enjoy your optimism. And I hope that that one extra justice can come in and
well,
start turning the tide.
2016 is very important for that. Whoever gets elected in 2016 is going to have at least two appointments.
Well, Professor Bert Newbern, thank you very much for joining us here.